This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On Monday, Jay Leno takes part in one of the most significant and potentially game-changing experiments in TV history. The former host of NBC's Tonight Show is taking his act to primetime on the same network in a comedy and talk show that gobbles up 5 key hours of TV time every week. If Leno succeeds, and other networks follow suit with low-cost programming instead of expensive dramas, broadcast television as we know it will be vastly different. If he fails, well, it's just the latest high-risk gamble by a veteran hard-working comic whose memoir was called, quite fittingly, Leading with My Chin. Terry Gross spoke with Jay Leno in 1996 when his memoir was first published. He told her his childhood was different from those of many other comics.
Most comics that I've read about or met always seem to have these horrible childhoods, and the comedy come out of this horrible pain, which is legitimate, certainly. It just didn't work that way for me. For me, the humor was always the fact that my parents were in their 40s when I was born. And besides my mom being an immigrant from Scotland, my mom being Italian, the differences were so horrific.
Your dad being Italian.
Yeah, which just hilarious to me. I mean, I'll never forget, you know, in that sort of teenage rebellion thing. I remember I was in the eighth grade when the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show. And, you know, I said, "Hey, Dad, the Beatles are going to be on." You know, my father, Beatles or whatever that is, you know. And so anyway, the Beatles come on and they're singing, "Yeah, yeah, whatever it is, I want to hold your hand." And I see my dad with the newspaper in front of his face, you know, deliberately not watching, you know. And I just said to him, I said, "You know, Dad, you know, the Beatles write all their own music." And my father just puts the paper down. He says, "Let me tell you something, you know, some manager gives these kids a couple of bucks to go out on a stage and act loony, and you kids all fall for it." And, you know, I couldn't even argue with that. It was so ridiculous. That was my father's whole explanation for the Beatles' career. Some guy gives them a couple of bucks, and they go out, and they act loony.
Do you remember your first laugh in front of an audience?
Yeah. This is sort of a story I've told a lot, but it's the first adult laugh. I remember always doing things. I remember the first thing I ever said that got attention, and I remember I couldn't have been more than maybe 4 or 5, but I remember I was over at one of my aunt's house, and my mom was there, and, you know, all the women were fussing around. There was some sort of get-together going on. In other words, just getting together for coffee or what it was, but it was like me and like 5 women, all my aunts and everything. And I remember saying to my mom, just making this observation, I said, "Mom, why do girls have humps like camels?" Well, of course, "Woo, woo, woo," all the women, "Oh, my God, did you hear what the child said? Woo!" I had no idea what I said. But I remember all the women, excuse me, running around, my mom going, oh, for goodness, and hustling me out of the room, and people laughing hysterically. And I'm thinking, what did I say? What did I say? The call, "Woo, woo, woo." You know, my aunt, you know, those kind of big women that would fan themselves when they heard something funny. "Woo, like this, you know, oh, the child, you know, heard me say." And I never got an answer to my question, but I just remembered that getting this tremendous reaction. And, you know, as a comic, I have a sort of a theory about comedians. They always remember everything that got a reaction, any kind of reaction. Just it's like it makes an etch in your brain, you know. And that was the first thing that ever got a reaction. And then the second time I remember it happening was in the fourth grade, and it was a joke. I didn't think it was that funny a joke, but at the time, it was the first joke I think I ever said that sounded like an adult joke. It wasn't just a kid joke. We were in Miss Allen, who was still a great friend of mine. She was my fourth grade teacher. And she's still teaching now. I realize now that must have been like her first year. And she was teaching us about Robin Hood, and, you know, the Sheriff of Nottingham was very cruel. And I remember her saying that when the Sheriff of Nottingham would catch Robin's men, he would boil them in oil. I remember putting my hand up, and I remember saying, well, he couldn't do that to Tuck. And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, he was a friar," you know, just a stupid joke. And it got kind of a laugh, and then I got scolded for it. But I remember later in the hall, I was walking down the hall, and one of the other teachers said, "Hey, Jay, come here. What did you say in Miss Allen's class? What was the joke you told?" I said, "Oh, they couldn't boil them in oil. He was a friar." "Oh, yes." And then another teacher asked me about it, and I said, "Geez, I like this. You know, this is great, this sort of feeling of influence. This is terrific." And it just always kind of stayed with me.
All he ever wanted was a little bit of attention.
Just a little bit of attention.
Was your humor ever considered a behavioral problem?
Yeah, as a kid, I was one of those hyperactive kids. And, you know, I was the classic, Jay has the ability but does not apply himself. You know, if Jay spent as much time studying as he does trying to be funny, I mean, I still have that on my report card from Mr. Simon, my fifth grade teacher, that if I spent as much time studying as I do trying to be funny, I would be a big-time comedian or something like that. And, of course, I hear from Mr. Simon all the time now about, oh, how prophetic he was, and I, you know, and it just kind of makes me laugh.
When you were starting in comedy, there weren't comedy clubs yet, not as we know them. Some of the venues that you played included retirement homes, prisons, mental hospitals. This is through a state program in Massachusetts where I think you got like $10.
We used to get $10 a show to do old people's birthday parties for the state. We used to do prisons. I did a show at like Walpole State Prison. And prisoners are not a good audience. You know, because comedy is based on a certain civility. Hi, folks, how are you? You know, and when you got a guy sitting in the front row and he's got a little blonde kid on a choke chain wearing underpants sitting on the floor next to him, that's not an ideal audience, you know?
What material would you do in your
prison?
Just
do your regular act. I only had my act growing up, whatever. You know, I used to do these psychiatric homes, and they get like, you know, and this is not to make fun of psychiatric patients, but, you know, you go there, hi, everybody, how you doing? And then, like, in the middle of your act, there'd be a guy in the corner going, ah! Ah! And then orderlies would come in. And of course, this would just break the mood of the whole room, you know. Say, anybody here from Boston? Ah! Ah! You know, hey, calm down there, fella. How you doing? You know.
Well, did this give you confidence performing in front of people?
Well, it was fascinating because you realized, it wasn't until I performed at, like, this place called Lenny's on the Turnpike in Boston that I ever got a professional audience. You know, I could always say in my own mind, well, you know, the audience, it's a psychiatric hospital. They didn't laugh because there's obviously something wrong with them.
Well, you can say, right, they don't laugh. They're crazy.
Yeah, it was like strip clubs.
Yeah.
When I would play strip clubs, they wouldn't laugh or applaud or do anything. But it gave you the confidence just to stand on stage because the people weren't paying any attention to me anyway. I mean, there's a story in the book about playing this club called the Mineshaft, where it was in Minnesota. People would pay $5 to get in, and then for another $5, the customers would get a miner's hat with a light on it. Now, there were no lights in the club. It was just a big, empty building. And the women would come out and dance, and, of course, the guys had the lights on their heads, and they would look at whatever part of the woman they wanted to look at with the light, and I would just be standing in the darkness, telling jokes. Hi, everybody. How you doing? Occasionally, somebody would look over at me, and I couldn't even look at them because they had the bright light on their head. So if they looked at me, ow, it burned my eye. I had to look away. So most of the time, for the whole week, I was just standing in darkness while guys looked at these women with those miner's hats on.
On your first shot on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, did he laugh at your jokes?
Yeah, he was very good, actually. He was a terrific audience. I mean, that's what The Tonight Show is. It's not trying to get the audience to laugh. It's trying to get Johnny to laugh.
Right.
But, you know, the audience gets the cue from the host.
Right.
And if Johnny is laughing, they're enjoying it more.
Did Johnny Carson give you advice about your stand-up act or later on about guest hosting or hosting when you took over?
Not so much about hosting, but he did about, you know, the first time I did The Tonight Show. Well, actually, I was a guy that was sort of the last of my graduating class to do The Tonight Show. By graduating class, I mean all the guys I sort of started with, Robin Williams and, Letterman and guys like George Miller and so many of the comics. They all did it before me. And, you know, Johnny came in one night at the Improv to see me. Harvey Korman brought him in. And, you know, there are two kind of comedians. There are comedians that have a lot of attitude and not many jokes. There are comedians that have a lot of jokes but not much stage persona. By attitude, I mean those kind of comics and get on stage and go, hey, pal, nice hat. All right, what did you win? Did somebody guess your weight? You know, that kind of thing. And they're loud and they're boisterous and they're just funny in their nature, but there are no jokes. And then there are other comedians like, you take a guy like Stephen Wright, who are just natural joke writers. You know, very monotone. They tell the joke a certain way. And to me, the best comedians are the ones that combine both those elements. You have a joke and you have an attitude. I remember Johnny came to see me and he said, you know, he thought I was funny, but I wasn't ready for the show because my jokes were too far apart. You know, I didn't quite understand what he meant, but I listened. And then I started watching his monologue and I realized, you know, he was doing 15 or 20 jokes in a space where I was doing 5. I mean, I could get on stage and being sort of physically big and loud and imposing, I could get a laugh where there wasn't any. But that really, that was great for a nightclub, but not for TV. You know, the idea being on television, if the joke doesn't work, your funny attitude will carry you through. And if your funny attitude doesn't carry you through, your joke will carry you through. And if they both work, you got a killer joke, you know?
You strike me as more secure, less insecure than a lot of comics.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty secure that way.
Less neurotic?
No, I'm not neurotic at all, actually. I'm not neurotic at all. I mean, I, you know, Rich Lewis is a friend of mine, and he, you know, I watch him agonize. You know,
right.
He agonizes over every little thing. What's the joke? You like that joke. You know, Rich will say, here's a joke. He'll tell you the joke, and you go, eh, it's funny. No, you didn't think it was funny. It was funny. Yeah, how funny was it? It was really funny. No, it wasn't that funny. You're being polite. And this will go on for days. It'll go on for weeks if you let it. And you know, I said to myself, my God, where does that come from?
So you don't understand neurosis?
Well, I mean, I understand it, and I'm lucky I don't necessarily suffer from it.
You're kind of famous for hating vacations, for not liking to not work. You like to work a lot. Is that still true, that you still don't like vacations?
I'm not a vacation guy. You know, I was somewhat dyslexic as a kid, and I always remember my mom saying to me, well, you're just going to have to work that much harder than the other kids to get the same thing. And when you brought up being insecure before, I never thought I was insecure. I just thought I was being lazy. And that may sound silly, but to me, if something didn't work, it didn't work because I wasn't working hard enough. Like when the whole thing with The Tonight Show was going on, is Jay going to be replaced? Is he going to get fired? They're going to replace him with Letterman. Well, obviously 16 hours a day is not enough. Maybe I need to do 18 hours a day. And it worked, you know. I mean, that's what works for me. You know, I never said I was the best. I never said I was the funniest. I just said I will work at this harder than anybody else. And that seems fair. I mean, that's sort of the American way, you know. I've always been a guy that worked on commission. Even when I was washing cars or had regular jobs, I was never a salary guy. I was always the kind of guy that would say, listen, why don't you pay me by whatever? You know, when I took over the Tonight Show, when I used to go into bars with the $50. If you think it's good, pay me what you think it's worth. And eventually, do you get screwed at the beginning? Yeah, but everybody gets screwed at the beginning. You know, to this day, people say, oh, you're getting screwed. Really? I mean, I do very well. I hosted the Tonight Show. I got the job I wanted. I mean, it's what works for me. And in my mind, if I'm one of those guys, like if I take a, you know, I went to Hawaii once. This was like a nightmare. I was doing a gig in Hawaii and I had to stay down there like 3 days. And the second day, I'm sitting on the beach, and I look at my watch, 10 o'clock. I'm sitting on the beach about 4 hours, and I look at my watch, and it's 10:30, and I go, great, my watch broke. The battery's dead. And then I ask them, what time is it? And they said, it's 10:30. And I said, really? I've only been sitting here for half an hour? I thought it was like 2 o'clock. This is like a nightmare. Get me out of here. And, I'm not a vacation guy.
Jay Leno speaking to Terry Gross in 1996. On Monday, The Jay Leno Show premieres on NBC in primetime 5 nights a week.